Succession number 28496, Reel 1.
Ted Whitley, Reel 1. Can you tell me when and where you were born, please?
Oh, home first in Yorkshire, 22nd of November 1921.
And what did your father and mother do for a living?
Well, my father was a maintenance fitter in a textile mill. My mother had had office jobs with one of her brothers or stepbrothers who was a baker, had a bakery business. But she, in my lifetime, she was a housewife.
Can you tell us something about your education?
Well, I went to the nearest village school and eventually got a scholarship to a grammar school. And they built a new one in Honley, which was called Home Valley Grammar School. And I think I was there in either the first or second year of its after it was opened.
And when did you leave school?
I left school when I was 15. I used to take my father meals to the textile factory, which was hot and steamy and noisy, and I didn't want anything to do with that. Lots of the boys went to Davy Brown's in Huddersfield, and we went to a boxing match there, and there were rows and rows of ladies with people making the same thing, and I didn't want anything to do with that. And I was interested in aircraft, so when a notice came upon the school board for the examination at the entrance to Halton, I took it.
This interest in aircraft, how had that been kind of fostered?
Well, through modelling, really. And obviously, I mean, even in the 30s, flying was a sort of a dodgy business. And I don't know. I was just interested.
You say modelling. Did you make models and fly them?
Yeah. Well, I made one, a Bristol Bulldog, which was about first choice, and it only ever flew once. That's it. Crashed. And we used to play with those plastic ones that you fired with elastic. It's very hilly where I live. You see, and you could stand on top of a hill and they fly forever.
So how did you go about joining the Air Force?
Well, I just took the exam. And then when the results came out, I had passed and was accepted. And despite the fact that my parents would probably have thought another wage earner might have been a good idea, they didn't stand in my way. We were given a warrant to go down to Wendover. Then we were picked up at Wendover and carted into Halton and stuck in a barrack room with loads of chaps from all over Britain, which was a very chastening experience. And then we had a medical exam, and they said, well, you can never be a pilot. I didn't particularly want to be. I got to have defective colour vision. And then we started a long and very, very good training. And there are people from Halton with all sorts of jobs all over the place. You keep coming across them. You did school two mornings a week. You did workshops all the other mornings. And most of the afternoons were either sport or bull. We'll leave off the other word. You came out there, although you didn't have about HNC equivalent.
What type of exam had you had to take, though, to go into to get into Halton in the first place? What was the initial examination like?
Well, there was science and maths in it. I came 67th out of 2,000, and I'd forgotten one question, which worried me a bit until the results came out. And I suppose there was a bit of a chemistry and a bit of general knowledge, but they wanted people with maths or physics, and also, of course, we did woodwork and metalwork at the school I went to, and you had a basic training. But some of the apprentices who hadn't had any, they would bash their thumbs on week one. Those of us who had a bit of practice used to bash our thumbs on about week five and do much more damage, you know.
How did the training start? If we take kind of the workshop work that you would have been involved with to start with, how did they take that from, say, the first year? What level would you start at?
Well, you started off with a lump of metal and you filed it square, and you chipped grooves across it with a hammer and chisel, and then you filed that square. And then you made a very famous test job, which was a cast iron block with a square, you know, filed in the middle of it, and there was a brass, I think it was a brass square made to fit in that hole. And they then concentrated more on the sheet metalwork side of things. Metal bending, riveting, aircraft repairing.
Obviously at that stage, the types of aircraft that you were supposed to work on, were those important things for those kind of biplanes that would have been around in the
north? Oh yes, they were very old aircraft. I mean, we did chain swinging, which is, there was a thing called a Huck starter for starting some of the bigger aircraft. It's like the starting handle on a car, driven by an overhead shaft on a Model T Ford. Now, if you didn't have that, three of you would swing the propeller, and we did that on a Bristol fighter. And they were armed somewhat without atlases. All the Hawker biplanes and some of the Western biplanes, because all their structure was the same. You know, they were a tubular metal structure, and you knew how to repair the tubes and the plates that joined them and so on. You also had to rig them. They had bracing wires and loads of bracing wires, plumb bobs and spirit levels and things to set up the whole fuselage. And then, of course, there was the light alloy covering, or wood or light alloy covering, and the fabric. So we did fabric work as well. We also did training on engines, and you started off on a small four-cylinder engine, and then you worked your way up onto the Rolls-Royce Kestrel and the Bristol engines, and an Armstrong Whitworth one. You did work on all of them, and the small engine that you started on, you took that to pieces and then you put it together and you ran it outside and had it start up.
With the, you mentioned the canvas work.
Yes.
What did that entail?
Well, it was Irish linen, 90 warp and 80 weft that I can remember. You sometimes inspected the aircraft by cutting it open. You had to replace that with herringbone stitch, and then you had to cover the cut with fabric that you'd doped on with cellulose dope, which A, tautened the fabric, and B, made it waterproof and made it a bit stronger. And initially you had to fray the warp and weft of these patches that you used, which was a tedious job, until somebody invented pinking shears, which made life a lot easier. You also had to learn how to string the fabric onto the wing, because the fabric went over the wing, was sewn up at the trailing at the after edge of the wing, and then you put this braided waxed cord with long needles, you stuck it through, and there was a particular knot, and then you went along and did the next bit. We had Hurricanes and Spitfires, Blenheims and so on, and we were trained on those as well. So we obviously did hydraulics and pneumatics and so on, and how all the control systems worked and so on. And my first squadron was a Swordfish squadron, and I was very disappointed after having been trained on much more modern aircraft. But when we went to sea and you saw how much easier they were to look after than the Fulmer, which was the fighter on the carrier, you grew to love the Swordfish. And you were certainly using all this sewing business.
Can I ask you about the rigging? You mentioned a little bit about
Yeah.
How do you go about rigging an aircraft? What was the kind of process that you would do?
Well, if you have the basic fuselage, which is the body of it, you have the tan trestles. And it's really a square structure with sort of four long members called longerons, struts in between, and then bracing wires and cross struts. So first of all, you adjust all the bracing wires on in the center of the panels until they're all exactly square, and that all the spirit levels dropping off the center of them are all over a long line on the ground. Having done that, when the wings are attached, you have special boards with spirit levels that you put on the wings at special places, so that you get the angle of incidence of the wing right. I mean, the wing has a certain angle of incidence, otherwise it doesn't give much lift. And you would also, of course, have a dihedral angle, which is for stability. And all these wires and things would have to be tightened up to the right tension and then locked using these spirit levels. And it was quite a long and tedious old business. Of course, you no longer need to do it with the metal aircraft. Well, you had to set up the control, and you had to measure the control movements and so on, and make sure they were going in the right direction.
And you also mentioned sheet metal working.
Yes.
What did that involve at that early stage?
Well, if an aircraft got damaged with anti-aircraft splinters or guns from a fighter, there were holes in it, and they had to be patched with patches which riveted on. If the damage was greater, you obviously had a much bigger job. And for example, they had a walrus at Halton, the old air sea rescue amphibian, which they were going to use for instructional purposes, and the fin of that aircraft was very badly damaged. And I was with a team of people, we were building a new fin on it, making the ribs for the fin and the spars and so on, and then putting the skin over. And in Malta, we had an aircraft that was very badly damaged by bomb splinters. And the main, this was a metal structure, but it had still has longerons running through it for strength. And we repaired that using cut-up bits of aluminium alloy propellers, because there was nothing else there in Malta during the siege. And we also made a swordfish starboard bottom wing into a swordfish port bottom wing in a garage in a village called Crendy. So all the training that we'd done did come in useful. And of course, during the war, we did all sorts of things that weren't in the book, because you had to get the aircraft flying again, especially if you were in a place where, you know, you couldn't get the new ones from the factory easily.
What about your daily routine while you were at Halton?
Reveille, 6:30, I think it was. And then there was something called gunfire. You could go outside and get a mug of tea and a biscuit. And then there'd be PT or drill. Go in for breakfast, get a large mug of milk, and go and get your breakfast, eat your breakfast, go back to the billet, fall in, march down to the workshops or the school or the airfield, which was a long way away. I played in the band, so we used to play in the band up and down the road. Arrive in the workshops, and there were quite big classes with civilian, mainly civilian instructors. There were some service instructors. And in the early days, you metal bashed all morning and so on. And then as time went on, you moved on to the engine work and the rest of it. Then you marched back up to the billet for lunch, or dinner, as it was called in those days. And probably in the afternoon, I think everybody in the establishment did sports on a Wednesday afternoon. You had a wing sports afternoon. Friday afternoon was the bull afternoon. You went to either school or workshops on Saturday morning, but Saturday afternoon was off. And of course, there was a parade and church on Sunday morning.
What about your accommodation there?
The accommodation was some barrack blocks designed by Lutyen. And there were three stories, one room each side of the central stairs and so on. And the toilets and showers and baths were also in this, and drying room, in the bit in the middle. Each room took 20 odd apprentices. You had a locker on the wall for your kit, you had a bed and all the bedding, and a wooden locker at the side of the bed. And there was a room in the corner which would be either a corporal or a corporal apprentice. There were leading apprentices, corporal apprentices and sergeant apprentices, so they looked after you. And you all had a job to do. I was always the room clerk, you see, make out the laundry lists and do all that sort of thing, much easier than scrubbing the loos.
What about your split?
It was pretty strict. There was really no nonsense. Lights out was 9:30, and you're all expected to be in bed and quiet. You weren't really allowed radios, but we did have some illegal ones. You know, pile of books, hole cut in the middle, little radio in it. And, for example, before you went out, you had to walk past the service police at the gate. They would check that you were properly dressed and so on. And if there were any real villains, people would occasionally be chucked out.
Did you ever witness any of those sort of occasions when there was somebody who was...
Yes, I did see somebody when, you know, they pulled all the buttons and things off the uniform and marched them out of the gates, but I only ever saw it once.
What was that for? What type of crime would that have been for?
I can't, well, you know, there were 1,000 apprentices in each wing, and I don't really remember. But obviously, if anybody was showing homosexual tendencies, they would be out. And if people were stealing things.
Was there punishment for things like smoking cigarettes, that sort of thing?
Oh, yes, you had to get a smoking pass. You didn't get that until, I think, you were 18. Because I can't have had one very long, because it was only just after 18 when I passed out. Yes, you had to have a smoking pass, and you wouldn't walk around the establishment smoking. And you wouldn't walk across the barrack square, you'd run double across it. It was... the Air Force was a mixture of the Army and the Navy, because they'd obviously had a mixture of the Royal Flying Corps and the Royal Naval Air Service, so a lot of naval things are in its port and starboard and forward and aft, but sort of army square bashing and saluting, you know, the up and over rather than the don't bash your fingers on the deckhead.
You mentioned sport. Was there a lot of emphasis put on sport as well?
Yes. Yes, you were expected, you would definitely have to do something. There was football, cricket, rugby, hockey, baseball, oddly enough. And, of course, athletics, swimming. And if you were in the band, maybe on a sports day, you may be doing band practice. But I was no good at ball games, so I used to do running. So you could go on a training run and be back and have a shower while the water was still hot before it ran out.
Were you given a certain amount of freedom into as to what type of sports that you would like to pursue?
Oh, yes. Yes, for example, we had a chap who'd come from India. His parents were in India, and he was very good at hockey and that sort of thing. But I think most people followed what they'd done at school and what they could do. But there was quite a strong emphasis on it.
What did you play in the band?
Side drum. Because my father was a drummer.
What was the role with that? You obviously mentioned you would lead the apprentices.
That's right, yes.
And that sort of thing. Would you play on any other occasions?
Well, we used to play at some local functions. We also did local armistice services. I was at the Cenotaph in 1938, mainly because there was a gap in the entries in the wing I was in, so we very quickly became the senior entry in the wing. Otherwise, somebody else would have gone. And we played at a garden party in the officers' mess. And, of course, we put on a great display on open days. Parents had an open day for parents.
What would you do on these open days? What would the place look like?
Well, the back rooms would all be... spruce up a bit better, and you know, the people could be shown around the workshops, and then they would all gather for a marching and a band display, usually down on the airfield or the sports grounds near the airfield.
And what about your personal appearance? What would you wear as an apprentice?
Well, you had an Air Force uniform, and that's it there. And you had a band round your hat saying which wing you were in, And of course, this was the uniform for marching around parades and so on. For ordinary to and fro, we had a Glengarry. And then you had overalls. You'd go to school like this, you'd go to workshops like this, but then you'd wear overalls.
Did you ever wear putties at all?
We were the first entry not to get putties. So entries pre-January 1937 had putties. And if you could scrounge one of the tunics that went with the putties, which clamped round the neck here and didn't have a collar and tie, that was a nice thing to scrounge, because you could go to workshops in that and you didn't need a collar and tie. And I had one for a bit.
Around you said that the band around the hat signified the wing. Were they different colours?
Oh, yes. Red two wing, green one wing, yellow four, I think, and then checkered blue and white for number three. And I think later there was a five, but that was after my time.
And what wing were you?
Two.
So, what was the standard of personal appearance expected for that? Because you mentioned a certain amount of bull earlier on. How did that work out with the personal appearance?
Well, you had to be very, very smart, and your boots had to be clean. And, clean. You're sent stuff off to the laundry every week, so you always had a clean shirt. I can't remember now, the collars, I think, whether they were collar-attached shirts or whether they had to put the collars on. But you were expected to be properly dressed. It's all part of getting people into discipline and so on, for them to be smart and properly dressed and taking a pride in their appearance.
And with the RAF at that time being a relatively young service, was there a lot of emphasis, would you say, on it then to establish it as with kind of a service ethos and look?
Well, there was always a bit of, you're the youngest service sort of thing. But if you were an Air Force apprentice, as I was at the beginning, I don't think you bothered very much about it at that time.
And you mentioned earlier that obviously there were people from the Dominions at that time.
Yeah.
Whose parents were. Were there any people from the Commonwealth who were, I'm thinking of Australians or New Zealanders or Indians, who might be in your...
No, this sort of thing came later on, and in the war, of course, there were a lot of Polish apprentices were trained at Halton, and I think people came over and joined anyway, but they were not sort of Royal Australian Air Force or Royal New Zealand Air Force, but we did have people from these countries.
What was your opinion of the training that you got there, the levels and standards? Was it a good grounding for the rest of your career?
I thought it was excellent. And I think everybody would agree.
How were you monitored through the course? Was there a set of examinations, or was it a constant kind of monitoring by the instructors?
Well, you were writing quite comprehensive notebooks on each stage of the course, which was cleared and marked by your instructor. And there was, of course, a passing out technical and a passing out school exam and a passing out test job at the end of the training. And that was, the test job was quite a difficult thing to do. And the technical board really consisted of loads and loads of questions by an Air Force NCO instructor as you were walking around the aircraft. And you had to write a set task of 1,000 words on a subject which you chose from a list. Of course, the war came before our entry was due to pass out, and the Air Force, by this time, I transferred to the Navy in the middle of 1939, and all the chaps in the Air Force chaps in my entry and the one after it were whistled straight off to the war. We stayed behind, and we thought it was the Admiralty getting their money's worth, but of course we realised afterwards they didn't have the ships and aircraft ready for all of us at that time. So we did the course, we did the test job, we did the passing out exam. I wrote the set task, which was never marked, which rather annoyed me. And I can't find it now, which is a great pity.
What was it on the set task?
The German High Seas Fleet in World War One.
Was there any element of choice as to what subjects you could have in this?
You had a list. And because I was transferring to the Navy, I picked that subject.
Could I just ask a little bit actually about that, about the education side of things as well? You said obviously you went to school, but what kind of educational lessons were you receiving at that time?
You're doing machine drawing, maths, physics, chemistry. There was an element of general knowledge, but it was mainly technical.
Was there anything on the RAF tradition side of things, or the history of the RAF at that stage?
No, I don't think so.
Can you give me the background of how you came to transfer into the Navy?
I don't know. What actually happened, the offer was made, and I didn't take up the first offer. And then, I don't know why, whether it was because it was a change of uniform or a change of possible career, or whether I'd seen this aircraft carrier being launched on the cinema newsreel, but I opted to go on the second choice. So in about June 1939, we whistled off to another wing, and we got naval uniform and hammocks, which we tried out on the lockers which were bolted to the barrack walls. And we had naval officers and petty officers and chiefs and chaps giving us a bit of naval drill, and they were telling us a bit about the Navy, of course they were.
What did your uniform consist of as a naval sort of apprentice?
Well, it was a navy serge jacket and trousers, a peaked cap. It wasn't the sailor's rig. White shirt, black tie for best wear, and then we had a special a grey shirt for working. It was a patterned shirt. And people, when you went to an Air Force training establishment years later and you had one of these shirts, people knew you were an ex-Holton apprentice.
And obviously, you mentioned the war started at that time. Had you anticipated that a war was coming, or did you think you'd take part in it?
No, we all knew, because the vast increase in the number of people being trained, and, you know, bits in the paper and bits on the radio, and I think we all realised it was coming. I mean, they had some German officer there, quite a famous Luftwaffe chap, and we all marched past him. I think we all went round the block and marched past him again, so he probably thought there were more of us than there were.
What was he visiting?
He was visiting Holton. This would be in about 38, I think. 38. I can't remember the details. It'll be in some magazine loafing about somewhere, but I can't remember now. He was a very, very famous German aviator.
So you remained at Holton, obviously, when you were
declared. That's right, yeah.
How long did you remain at Holton for?
Until December. We finished the full three-year apprenticeship. And then we had a sort of a speech day passing out, and we were all whistled off to a camp on the Isle of Wight at Puckpool near Ryde, which was a clearance camp. And we met up there with chaps who've been in sailor's rig, who've been trained as air mechanics and so on, and Air Force people, because there were a lot of Air Force people still in the fleet armour, and they remained for a long time.
What rank did you have once you'd finished as an apprentice?
You were an air fitter. And then they had, in our initial training, we'd done both engines and airframes. And then at some stage, and I think when they wanted to speed things up for the war, that you became either engine or airframes. And I became an air fitter, airframes. So although I'd been trained on engines, I was technically working on the aircraft.
So could you explain to me the responsibilities? Obviously, is it everything other than the engine then, really?
Yes.
There's no other...
Well, the electrics and guns and bombs weren't yours.
Who would do that?
Well, they had armourers and electrical fitters.
So there was a whole raft of people for...
That's right. A frontline squadron at the beginning of the war would have a fitter and a rigger per aircraft. Each three aircraft would have a corporal, in each trade supervising that group of aircraft. There'd be a sergeant over half a dozen, a flight sergeant over the whole squadron, and then you would have a small number of electricians and armourers and radio people, because in those days you fixed the aeroplane and then told the electrician to put the battery back. It was not like it was later on when both of you had to sort out the problems because half of it was electrical, you know.